G'day, Tom Switzer here. Welcome to RN Summer. Well, last month marked the anniversaries of two Russian revolutions. The revolution that brought down the Tsarist regime in February-March of 1917 and the Bolshevik Revolution later that year. They were considered to be the most influential events of the modern era. Some say on par with the American Revolution of 1776 or the French Revolution of 1789. Now, it's been said that in the matter of scale, the communists of Russia and their later successors in China from 1949 onwards, they achieved a record of mass killings worse than even the Nazis. But were the Soviet Union's ills less the distortions of Leninism rather than its ultimate fruit? Well, to mark the centenary, let's turn to two leading specialists in Soviet history. Catherine Merridale is the author of Lenin on the Train. She joins me on the line from London. Hi there, Kathy.
Hello.
And Sheila Fitzpatrick is author of Mishka's War, A European Odyssey. She's with me in the Sydney studio. The fourth edition of her landmark book, The Russian Revolution, has just come out. Hi there, Sheila.
Hello.
Now, Sheila, the Kremlin fears revolutions and Putin is apparently refusing to celebrate the Bolshevik Revolution. Why?
It's very strange, isn't it? You would really expect them to celebrate it. Well, first of all, I think he thinks revolutions are divisive and they cause trouble. So he doesn't want to celebrate anything like that. Secondly, I think he himself is not quite sure what he thinks about it. Putin is quite keen on Stalin, who's the great Russian nation builder, but Lenin and the revolution he's less keen on.
How are the Russian people reacting to the revolution, Kathy? I mean, after all, a majority of them are children of labourers for whom the revolution apparently provided social advancement.
Most of them don't even know about it anymore. I mean, it used to be something that was celebrated every year and remembered every time anybody walked past a statue of Lenin or a poster. Russians seem to have almost put the revolution into a back room and shut the door on it. And instead of celebrating 1917, I think we're going to find that next year there's a huge amount of commemoration of the Romanovs, because that's something they do want to remember. They want to remember they had a czar and they were a great nation. They don't want to remember that they had a different kind of greatness in 1917.
Well, look, we'll return to Putin's Russia later in the program, but let's put 1917 in a broader European historical context. Sheila, why had Russia been immune to the continent's revolutionary upheavals of the 18th and the 19th centuries?
Well, it was always said Russia was backward, and I suppose you might say backward in that way too. That means they were late in industrializing, so late in getting a large urban population. Mm. Also, they had an autocratic government, so the penalties for causing any trouble were greater. But what you find from about the 1860s is that you get a radical intelligentsia developing.
This is after the emancipation of the serfs, right?
Yes, along with that. You get a radical intelligentsia with westernised ideas critical of the Tsars, and so revolution, or at least social protest, comes to seem a bit closer.
Yeah, well, Sheila, I was very fortunate to study Russian history at both high school and university, and a classic high school question in your HSE, in your high school certificate, was, could the revolutions have been averted if it were not for World War I and the loss of about, 3 million Russians?
Yeah, well, I certainly go along with the idea in general that nothing is inevitable in history. Therefore, of course, history could have gone another way. And certainly the war and all those war losses were a tremendous factor in increasing unrest. You have to remember that just in 1905, just really not much more than a decade ago, they had a revolution that almost toppled the Tsar. Mm. So that you add war to that already precarious situation and it tips.
Yeah, well, some scholars say that the writing was on the wall in 1905 and that Tsar Nicholas II should have used that revolution to put into place more democratic reforms, perhaps.
Well, of course, he did put in some. That's when they created a parliament, the Duma.
Duma, yeah.
Yeah, so he did something. And there's the agricultural reform. Well, it wasn't enough. There wasn't a lot of time.
Yes.
1905 to 14.
Yeah. Well, Kathy, on the on your excellent book, Lenin on the Train, I was struck by a review of it in the London Times by David Aronovich, and he said, quote, Twice I miss my stop on the tube reading this book, which doesn't usually happen with histories. and then he calls your book, quote, a jewel among histories, taking a single episode from the penultimate year of the Great War, illuminating a continent, a revolution, and a series of psychologies in a moment of cataclysm, and doing it with wit, judgment, and an eye for telling detail. Now, you write...
I have to tell your listeners that he is no relative.
But you write in your book that Lenin's arrival in Petrograd in 1917, that was the turning point in the revolutionary drama.
That's right. The point about Lenin's return is that he changed the Bolshevik Party. He gave it a focus that it hadn't had before. Before Lenin came back, the Bolshevik Party was in danger of splitting and possibly parts of it merging with the other revolutionary parties. And there would have been a left-wing side of the revolution, but where it intended to go and what its policies were on things like the war and the Soviets would have been very unclear and disputed probably for the rest of the year. When Lenin came back, he delivered his clear, crisp and revolutionary April theses. Everybody thought he'd gone mad. Even his wife said she thought he'd gone mad. But in fact, by specifying what the Bolshevik Party should be doing, he gave it an identity which made it completely recognisable as the extreme left for the rest of the year. And in particular, he opposed Russia's continued involvement in the war, and he opposed any collaboration with the provisional government. He said, all power to the Soviets, land to the peasants, an end to the war, fraternization at the front. And although at the time these things sounded completely crazy, by the autumn he was beginning to sound like the sort of person people could do business with, the sort of person who would represent the bulk of the revolution best.
This is Tom Switzer, and you're on Between the Lines on RN. My guests are two of the leading authors on the Russian revolutionary period. Kathy, just keeping with you here, you mentioned that Lenin obviously opposed the war and Russia's involvement in World War I. Does that explain why the Germans directly financed the Bolsheviks, or at least helped play a role in financing the Bolsheviks?
Of course. The Bolsheviks, by opposing the war, were doing exactly what the Germans wanted. During the First World War, the Germans found themselves fighting on two fronts, on the Western Front against the British and French, and on the Eastern Front against the Russians. And what they needed to do was to stop that two-front war. And the softest target was Russia, although they tried to disrupt the British by encouraging Irish nationalism. They tried to encourage problems in the Middle East. They tried to foment a revolutionary war in Finland too. But Lenin was a great candidate for disrupting the Russian war effort. They didn't think he would end up building the Soviet Union. All they wanted him to do was make things difficult for the provisional government and destroy Russia's support for the war. And they did indeed finance him. There's almost no question about that.
Hey, you talk about German condoms helping finance Lenin's activities. Tell us about that.
Yes. I love that. I wish somebody would write a limerick, and I'm sure someone will. What was happening was that the Germans didn't give Lenin a bag of gold. Apart from anything else, how would he have got it to Russia without being detected? What was going on was that there was an illegal trade, a black market trade, in goods that were embargoed as a result of the war. Germany and Russia weren't allowed to trade directly with one another. However, Russia had always relied on Germany for pharmaceutical products, and still did. And in order to get those products to Russia, businessmen set up a black market chain that went from Germany to Denmark, where the goods were repackaged, and then from Denmark through Scandinavia and through this incredible land bridge in the north of Sweden at a place called Haparanda, into Finland and then down to Russia in Danish packaging. And the people who were doing this were making a lot of money, and a lot of that money was then ploughed back into the Bolshevik Party. Now, where did those goods come from? They came from Germany. The Germans were not necessarily requesting the full payment. The person who was in charge of this was a man called Fürstenberg, who was also Lenin's right-hand man in Scandinavia. And amongst the pharmaceuticals the Russians wanted most were indeed condoms.
That is absolutely fascinating. Sheila, when the Bolsheviks seized power late October, early November, what were some of the problems or impediments the Bolsheviks had to grapple with in the lead-up to that revolution?
When they seized power, the so-called October Revolution, that was not so hard, actually. That was a matter of taking a few buildings and coming into the Congress of Soviets.
All things considered, it was bloodless, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. And really, life went on as normal in the city. The problem was, when you've seized power, what do you do with it? I mean, think about it. These revolutionaries have spent their entire adult life as sort of journalists and underground organizers, and they have no administrative managerial experience whatsoever. I've always thought it was actually incredible how effectively Lenin set up a government and quickly, which at least had its sway in the capital cities. Now, governing the provinces was a whole different thing. And actually, we have this from 1918, there's a civil war that breaks out, and the Bolsheviks are not truly in power until they've won that war in 1921.
A lot of euphoria. I mean, Lenin's also seeing this as a precursor to world revolution, isn't he?
Yes, that was the hope and that was the expectation. Now, of course, the problem, if you're expecting world revolution and your theory says that other places deserve it more, like Germany, what do you do if you're left all by yourself? And there's been a lot of ink spilt as if one would expect the Bolsheviks to then say, okay, well, we'll hand it back now. If we took power under a misapprehension, but since there's no other revolution, we'll hand it back. They didn't do that, of course, and had to go it alone.
And Kathy, on that note, if you go back to 1917, there was an American reporter named John Reed. And as you know, he wrote an eyewitness book called 10 Days That Shook the World. And it conveyed a kind of thrill that the revolution evoked among those who considered capitalism doomed, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Famously played by Warren Beatty, of
course.
That's
right.
if you put yourself back in 1917 in the state of the world with the First World War, with millions of young men being blown to pieces in the trenches, for what? And the world seeming to be getting worse at the hands of these rich fat cats. So the cartoons of the time were lyrical about the subject of how bad capitalism was. Suddenly you had this bright light coming from the east, from Russia. Of course, John Reed got it wrong, but at the time his enthusiasm wasn't feigned in any way. And what he was seeing was a genuine workers' uprising, which he hoped would transport itself all across the globe.
Sheila, let's put this revolution in a broader Russian historical context. You're obviously very well aware of the historian Richard Pipes, and he's challenged the view that the Russian Revolution merely continued the long tradition of Russian authoritarianism. Is that a fair assessment?
It's, of course, a controversial one in a way. Mm. I mean, on the face of it, it can't possibly be the revolution itself that does that. Revolutions are anti-authoritarian. So the argument is that what comes afterwards, and in reaction, I suppose, to the upheaval of revolution, is a new authoritarian regime. That's true. That was what emerged under Lenin, but even more strikingly under Stalin.
Mm. But bear in mind, Kathy, we did have that provisional government. Now, I know it only lasted for about 6 or so months, but Alexander Kerensky was, by all accounts, a liberal Democrat, right?
Yes, he was, but he was also very keen on Alexander Kerensky. I mean, he was an extremely vain man. He loved to strut in front of the crowd. And I think when it came to thinking ahead about what the revolution might really mean, he wasn't very strategic. And right at the beginning, in February, when he had the choice of being the people's darling and working in the Soviet, which was the people's parliament, or working with the men in suits and monocles and cigars in the other wing of the Tauride Palace, which is where the provisional government was meeting, he disappeared off into the provisional government. He was very much a man of the elite. The power interested him. The revolution less so, except insofar as it gave his vanity some kind of support.
Yeah, and it's just occurred to me, I think in 2007, when Vladimir Putin came to Sydney for the APEC summit, I think there was a press conference where John Howard, the then Prime Minister, told Putin that Kerensky actually spent a few years living in Brisbane after the war and had a female journalist.
Yeah, that's right. He was married to an Australian, apparently.
And then when Howard told Putin this, he was astonished because why on earth would anyone marry a journalist? Former KGB guy was shocked. You're on RN. We're discussing the Bolshevik Revolution. My guests are Catherine Merridale and Sheila Fitzpatrick. Sheila's latest book, Mishka's War, it's arising from Sheila's marriage. It's recently received some glowing reviews in the London Telegraph, The Australian, The Sydney Morning Herald. Kathy, what should people today learn from the Bolshevik Revolution?
Oh, goodness, now that's a small question, isn't it? One thing we need to learn is that seizing power in the name of the people is a very dangerous way to go forward. If you claim that you are doing things in the name of the people, you'd better be pretty sure the people know what you're doing. And Lenin's good hopes, Lenin's good ideas were always something that he had to take control of. He was never going to allow the people to have a say in what direction the revolution went. And it's ironic, isn't it, that when a very powerful and imaginative politician seizes power on behalf of the people, there's always this sense that he's got to stay in charge because only he knows the way forward. And I think that was the great fault line in 1917. There were a lot of very imaginative people around in Russia, but in the end, they were the ones who had to emigrate in the 20s or faced arrest in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. On the lessons of 1917, Sheila, we had the British historian Max Hastings on this program last week, and he's remarked that with the crimes of the Stalin era, really in the 30s and 40s and early 50s, the centenary of the Russian Revolution of 1917 is something to be, quote, mourned, not celebrated.
Well, that has been a sort of motif in much of the commentary.
It's a conventional wisdom, isn't it?
It's a conventional wisdom in the time. I think he published that in The Spectator. And mm-hmm. that
late last year.
Yeah, had a lot of currency. That it's also very common to say, oh, well, the Russian Revolution was a failure. Now, of course, all revolutions are failures by definition. You're never going to be a revolution
forever.
Well, hang
on, tell that to the Americans. They still honour the American Revolution of 1776.
Well, let's not argue about the okay. American way. But
sure.
It's in the nature of revolution to stop being revolutionary, right? I mean, failure or success is to be judged on whether you implement any of your programme. Well, there, I think the Russian Revolution didn't do too badly.
Yes, but what about, I'll put you on the spot here, these true believers in the Soviet system, you know, the Webbs, the Bernard Shaws, the Western true believers, were they gullible about the Soviet system?
Well, they were hopeful. There was even more reason to be depressed as of post-1929 about what was going on in the West. This is the time of the Great Depression. So I think that the Webbs, of course, even though they visited for 2 months or whatever, they don't know a whole lot about it, but they hope it's okay. Mm. They hope there's somewhere where something is working.
Yeah, well, when I was studying Russian history at the University of Sydney in the 1990s, the conventional wisdom on campus was, and this was not just among Trotskyites and Leninists, it was an overwhelming view that Stalin betrayed Lenin and the Bolsheviks. But Kathy, is that true, or was he the logical outcome of the revolution?
Now, there's another essay question.
You know, preparing for this interview, I've just gone back to my old essay questions. Go on, Kathy.
The thing is that Stalin was a very different kind of person from Lenin and a very different kind of person from the original generation of Bolsheviks. They had formed their ideas in exile and in opposition. They were an underground party. Really, who had met in Europe were cosmopolitan, had thought about revolution in the abstract. Stalin was much more practical and earthy, and he'd also spent most of his pre-revolutionary career in what is now the Russian Empire, in Russia. And so his attitude was much more hands-on, let's get it fixed. In a way, you can see him as the practical outcome of Leninism, you know, getting it done, getting the peasants into collectives, getting industrialization pushed forward. Big differences, I think, are two. One is Lenin never believed in socialism in one country. He never believed that the revolution should be confined to Russia. He was always looking, until he died, for the revolution that was going to light up the world, and Russia was going to be the vanguard, but not the only part of that. And of course, by pushing the revolution into Russia only, Stalin's regime has consequences for Stalin. The other big difference is that Stalin was a personally vengeful person. Lenin never attended an execution. Lenin never wore a military uniform. He wasn't interested, and he certainly ordered lots and lots of executions personally, but he wasn't particularly interested in them, whereas Stalin actually enjoyed it, and he had a bullet on his desk, the one that was used to kill Kamenev. He was very keen on seeing his enemies disposed of, and he wasn't averse to actually watching the process.
We're commemorating the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. And on that note, Sheila, to what extent did the opening of the Russian archives following the collapse of the Soviet Union, to what extent did that reveal any hidden truths of the Lenin era?
It revealed quite a lot of Lenin's involvement in particular actions of terror in the Civil War, especially against priests, so that the argument, in complete contrast to Stalin, whereas Stalin was a man of blood, Lenin wasn't, that became harder to sustain.
Kathy?
The opening of the archives for me revealed the whole texture of Soviet life. When you only look at what is printed, you get a very schematic picture. And rather a dull picture, although the story of the revolution and of Stalinism can never be dull. But somehow or other, it was very mechanical. And as soon as the archives were opened, and Sheila was a pioneer of this, and her work is wonderful, you were able to get in there and understand what real people, how they negotiated this system, how they lived, what it was like having to deal with this state, this sort of Goliath that ordinary people had to negotiate every day. And you get a sense of humour, you get the jokes, you get personal tragedies, family stories, and also the ways in which ordinary people bent the rules in order to negotiate this state and to make real lives in it that become much more real the more of the archives we read.
And that brings us to Putin and 2017. You know, we all too often hear about, from Western pundits, they often equate Putin with Stalin. And he himself, Putin, he's declared the breakup of the Soviet Union as, quote, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Sheila, is Putin really trying to recreate the former Soviet empire?
I think that any Russian ruler, well, first of all, is going to be a nationalist, but a nationalist who thinks in terms of that broader nation.
Democrat or autocrat.
Yeah, can't imagine one who wouldn't take that position.
And let's remember Boris Yeltsin himself, who was the darling of the West. He was a strong opponent of NATO expansion, right?
Well, which Russian ruler wouldn't be? I think that what in the West looks is often taken to be a sort of wild expansion, expansionism on the Russian part, is a reaction to having NATO come so close to its borders.
Kathy, let's wrap it up here. In a recent review of a book called The Unwomanly Face of War, this was in the Wall Street Journal. Now, it was originally published when the Cold War was just coming to an end, and you wrote, quote, "Glasnost has arrived and it seemed good times surely lay ahead. The horror of a Stalingrad, of shelling, shots and dead young men seemed to belong to Europe's past." And you say, quote, "I miss that certainty today."
Yes, I do. And it's not the certainty of the Cold War that I miss so much as the certainty of feeling that the West was going to win. There was this smugness about us in the 1980s as the Soviet Union collapsed. A kind of feeling it's all going to be all right now, which of course was completely wrong. And at the same time, even in Russia, there was a feeling that things were going to get better, had to get better, but life was still going to be safe, secure, and provided for. People had pensions, children went to school. And I think all those things are beginning to crumble away. We no longer live in a bipolar world. We no longer live in a world in which anyone in Western Europe or Australia or Canada or anywhere else can feel safe and know where the next bullet is coming from. And I do miss the 1980s quite a lot.
Sheila?
I'd like to go back to the question of Putin's not celebrating the Russian Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
A year or so ago, before Putin made this attitude clear, his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, complained that the West probably wasn't going to recognize what was actually a glorious moment in Russian history. My sense is that Lavrov sense that the Russian Revolution is a great moment in Russian history that can't be altogether forgotten, that's going to come back. And well before the bicentenary of this revolution, we're going to see a different attitude in Russia.
Sheila, Catherine, what an intellectually stimulating conversation. Thanks so much for marking the Second Russian Revolution from 1917.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. It's been a great pleasure.
Catherine Merridale and Sheila Fitzpatrick are two of the world's leading experts on Russian history. And that's it for today. For more information, you can visit our website on abc.net.au/rn and look in for the programs for Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Let's chat next week.